Admin Happen podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, work on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get into a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Jerry.
Ah, but there's no Andy tonight. He can't make it, but we're kind of doing double recording in one weekend kind of thing to get more shows out there, so... How have you been, Jerry? You weren't on the last podcast. How, what you been up to, or how are things going?
Well, I've been into trying to get my house ready to move. So we're moving soon, so that's all been fun. And I must admit, I've been out enjoying the sunshine, not doing a whole lot of IT stuff. But yeah. Life is good, as they say.
Good. Yeah, I was going to say, I've been kind of trying a couple of different things. I was going to say, I've been trying out a bit of Debian Server to see how that kind of works, kind of sort of just branch out, really. I mean, I think you say that you use Debian Servers quite a lot, don't you, Jerry?
Is
that?
Yeah, I tend to put, if someone asks me to install a server for something, I usually choose Debian. Mainly because it's all the packages that are available for it, and you can be pretty sure it's all been tested as much as it can be tested, and it will just work basically. The other choice is CentOS, or which is basically Red Hat, a free version of Red Hat. And the problem with that tends to be that you need a package, but it's not available in the core CentOS packages, so you have to install third-party repositories and install the package from there. Mm-hmm. But which can be a bit more work. And whereas with Debian, it tends to be just everything that you might ever need is in this repository. So. That's generally why I'd recommend Debian.
We mainly use Red CentOS at work. That's kind of why I normally just kind of use that. But I want to just try Debian. I mean, most of the commands are kind of the same thing, but like the updates is different, isn't it? Kind of thing. So
yeah, I use a different package manager, which is really just a case of learning different commands to do the same thing. I've actually got a cheat sheet. I could put it in the show notes actually about if you're used to using yum in CentOS, then it's just got the equivalent things for apt-get, which is the Debian package manager, or dpkg, which is the equivalent of rpm.
Yep. So does the new version of Debian use systemd now then, if you download the latest version of Debian?
Yeah, the latest version, I believe, of Jesse, uses systemd. Now, I'm just trying to think, actually, because Jesse is still testing, right? Is that correct? I mean, I'm the Linux guy, so you should be asking me, but yeah, I think, because... maybe we should explain for the listeners. In Debian, you've always got a stable version, a testing version, and an unstable version. Now, the unstable version, that they're always named after Toy Story characters. So the unstable one is always called Sid.
It's already good.
Now that's the messed up kid in the first Toy Story, who made the toys, stuck different toys together to make weird. Screwed up toys. Now I think at the moment the next one down, testing, is called Jessie, who's the cowgirl in Toy Story 2, I believe. Testing is always usable, and in fact Sid, I think, is always usable. You just may get packages that haven't been properly tested and have bugs. Yeah. And so on. I think a lot of people use testing a lot of the time, but if you're sort of working in the enterprise or whatever, you'd want to use the stable version, which at the moment is Wheezy. Actually, at work we're using the older, what's called old stable, which is Squeeze. So, yeah, that's the latest Toy Story characters. Before that, I don't know the code names because I only started using Debian at Squeeze. So, and that's good.
So Debian 8 is Jesse. Is that sort of the current stable release? Wheezy is the obsolete, and then it goes Squeezy, yeah. Lenny.
So we're on at work. We're on old stable. Yeah. So I guess they must have switched.
Yeah, I think it's actually quite yeah. recent. I think
whether they put systemd in and then made that the stable version. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But how is that the first time you've used systemd then? How did you find it?
Yeah, it's different compared to just doing the init scripts and stuff. It's just I don't really do that much on it with, but and the other thing I was going to tell you is about that I've listening to the System of Trivia podcast, they were saying about trying different systems and Unix. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to try Debian. On my Linux box, I just run it Ubuntu, and it's just nice and stable kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I was getting a bit bored of it, so I was thinking about trying something different kind of could make me learn Linux a bit more. And they were talking about that they always use Brett always use they use Arch. So I basically set up Arch from scratch in a virtual machine. And I did it in a couple of hours kind of thing. Cause I was really surprised how it worked kind of thing. So I mean, I managed to get it installed and get XFCE installed. That's the desktop manager I kind of. That's the kind of like I can't seem to get on with the
KDE is the other big one.
KDE,
yeah.
I just can't seem to get on with them thing. They just don't seem to appeal to me.
Yeah, I don't know why. I've found XFCE a bit too flat and kind of grey and boring really. I've gone on about in past podcasts, I use Manjaro, which is that kind of it's Arch but underneath, but it's made it easier to use and probably, like we were saying earlier, ironing out some bugs, putting things like the Flash plugin for you so you don't have to. Mm-hmm. And when you install Manjaro, it's got a really nice installer, a bit like the Ubuntu installer really. Which gets you up and running really quickly, but underneath you've got all the power and possibly the problems of Arch, because it's so sort of bleeding edge, as they say.
I was talking to him on IRC about it, and they were saying you need to keep your update it a couple of times a week, to get everything.
With Manjaro, I found it's once every couple of weeks it's fine. But yeah, I mean, things can break and you then have to go and fix them. But as long as you've got a working web browser, you'll be fine, I think.
Yeah, so, and I was just going, the wiki is really good. I really enjoyed it. It's just plain simple. Because I've kind of messed about with Linux, I kind of knew what you had to do. So I was just going to... It's really good. So literally what you do is you basically download an ISO image and you basically boot up the ISO. And so you get no GUI for it. So you have to do everything by command line. So you have to set up the keyboard. And then luckily, because this is a virtual machine, it recognised Nick and it already gave it an IP address already.
Good, yeah.
So you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
But the wiki tells you how to do. And then basically then you have to set the hard disk up yourself by basically you can identify the drive by running lsblk and that basically just lists the disks. And then you basically use part ed to kind of basically create all the partitions, and because I've kind of messed about it Linux before, I mean if you never knew Linux before this would be a nightmare kind of thing, but because I kind of know the basics, and then you can obviously then it says you have to create the partition table. And then basically create the file system. Then it asks you to mount the partition, And then he basically installed the base system, which basically gets or goes off and gets like the basics, the basic OS basically, and then stores it on the actual your partition. Yeah.
I think it's a good exercise to go through. I mean, if you don't know Linux, it's a good exercise to go through something like Arch, because you learn about it, and then when you're using the any other system, you think, oh yeah, I know that command, and I know how to partition a disk or whatever if you ever need to do that. And it's just quite a good learning experience. Because
you kind of do things like you have to generate the FS tab, which is basically that file which basically just tells you what all the partitions are. And it's really good. And I mean, I then boot it all up, and the only difference is that it was that the way you then had to you had to configure the NIC manually. And because I think this is part of System D, I think is what I was going to ask you. It's System D hyphen Network D, and it just threw me a bit about what you had to do to get the name, the interface name. And it's like it wasn't like simple something like on CentOS where it just was like
ETH0.
Is it something like it's like some really random number you had it generated or something?
I'm booted into Windows at the moment, so I can't check. But maybe I can. This is live puttying.
And it was like really odd. Like it wasn't. It threw me a bit, kind of thing. To configure the NIC. You couldn't just.
Yeah, I mean, in these days on distributions, you've got Network Manager, which takes care of all that. This is my one. It's ENO1, not EN01, ENO1. But yeah, I mean that's good reason to choose Manjaro basically, because you kind of get your system up and running and then. You can worry about all that stuff later, but then it's also, like I was saying, valuable learning experience to go through the steps of setting up your network and so on.
So it's all good, but because obviously I was doing this via command by a virtual machine, in a virtual machine. I had to, obviously you couldn't copy and paste the commands so I had to manually write it out. But apparently what you can do is you can actually install it by SSH. So what you can do is you can basically boot the PC, boot the virtual machine or whatever the PC you're installing it on. When it gets an internet connection, you can then enable basically SSH using the NCurse installer. And then you can basically telnet SSH into that PC, virtual machine. And then you can obviously then paste all the commands in, so you haven't got to then
I mean, there's something to be said again for typing out the commands rather than copying and pasting. I don't know. I mean, the command line is powerful and is useful to learn, and it becomes like muscle memory after a while, you know.
Yeah, but the problem is I don't get to do it enough. That's my problem. I spent like ages like spelling something wrong or something, and then after going up and changing it or whatever.
That's what tab completion is for, you know. You type in a few letters and press tab, and then most of the time. See, I never type out the full command. And, you know, as time goes on, the tab completion gets better. You can complete more things. So it can get you into trouble if you complete the wrong thing, but it can also be very handy.
So have you got anything else interesting would otherwise work-wise or anything?
Some stuff at a day job, but I just wanted to mention a bit about iSinger 2, which I've been doing for one of my clients. It's a monitoring system, runs on Linux, and it's kind of it started out as a fork of Nagios. Now Nagios is the one of the sort of main sort of well supported or well known monitoring systems for Linux.
Yeah.
Now Isinger version 1 started out as basically a fork of Nagios, which, you know, it's just sort of reskinned, and they kind of replaced done a search and replaced Nagios for Isinger. But with version 2 they seem to have gone a bit further, and they've rewritten it completely. There's a talk on YouTube by a developer which probably explains it a lot better than I can, but they've re-architected the whole thing so that it overcomes the shortcomings of Nagios. I mean, things like Nagios itself is just a binary which runs, and it does all the stuff like it does all the checks and gets all the results and displays a nice web page for you, whereas Isinger is now multi-threaded and it's not just one process on one CPU, so it scales better, and also the way you configure Nagios is lots and lots of text files, and the configuration for that can be quite challenging, and I have to report back on this, but from what I can see, the syntax you can use with Isinger 2 is a lot more powerful. You can use conditional statements, so you can say you define the host and you define the OS of the host, and then you can say if the OS is Linux, do this, or if the OS is Windows, do this, which you just can't do that with Nagios.
Cool. Sounds quite good then.
I've put the talk in the show notes, so if anyone's interested in that, they get a good overview of it. And from what I can see at the moment, I recommend it. But I have to add a caveat to that I haven't finished the deployment yet, so I'll report back on that later.
So is that something you're using at work?
No, we're using Nagios at work
for a custom.
We're doing a big sort of push on Puppet at the moment at work, so I don't want to sort of bring in anything new until Puppet's done, really. So, but I'm using that, and I'm deploying it for a client. So he started out on Isinger, and I helped him out with that a bit, and he wanted me to sort of develop it further, and there's a lot of sort of back and forth, and then Isinger 2 came out, so it is quite new, Isinger 2. It's sort of very much I get the feeling that people that use it are sort of beta testers, if you like, but it seems pretty good and pretty powerful, so like I say, I have to report back on that in the future. That's kind of a lot of what I've been looking at. I've been using and getting into Puppet day job, but I mean maybe I'll talk about that in a bit, because I've got a bit of stuff to say about configuration management and how it's being used and so on, and a few mm-hmm. pointers on that. But
you've got some code on GitHub.
I think I put it in the show notes for the last show. I put a link to it, but I've got some actual code uploaded to GitHub, which is the first time I've ever done that. So,
what does the code do? Does it say hello world or something?
It could do. Someone could fork it and and make it say hello world. But it's for configuring. I'm going to have to look it up. Bear with me, listeners. There's two things in there. One of them is it's basically to install and configure software, which is most of what you do with configuration management. One of them is called something called Maldat, which is malware detection software for Linux, for Linux servers, really. And the other one is mail wrapper, which is it's just a little wrapper script for the mail server on Linux server, which will tell you what script is sending mail. So as one of the problems you come across on, I think I mentioned it a couple of podcasts ago actually, a script on a website is sending out email and it shouldn't be, and the reason for that is the script is insecure or the page is insecure, and you can you can put a script around the mail server, the thing that the mail server does to send the mail, to find out what PHP script is sending the mail, and there, you know, then tell the developer and they can sort it out basically, which is basically what my role is as this admin, is blame the developers of the web app. So there's those two Ansible roles, one for installing that Maildet software and one for installing that mail wrapper script. And this uses Ansible, which is another bit of configuration management software that I use quite extensively for my freelance clients. And it's just, all they do is they do it for me. So rather than typing in all this stuff, I can just point this at a server and it does it. It installs everything and off you go. I think you have to give it a few variables. You have to give them a few variables like... let's see.
Is the GitHub thing, is that the one which is like it's like a closed source bit of software?
Yeah, GitHub itself is closed source, but it's probably the biggest repository of open source software on the internet, which is a strange juxtaposition, if you like. It's many people use it, many companies use it, they just dump their code there, and Git is a version control system, so you put your code in there, you commit your code to it, and then you can roll back to previous versions, or you can fork the code, or you can create branches in the code and then merge those branches back into the mainline, or any number of things. But if you put your code on GitHub, anyone with Git, which is basically any Linux machine or Windows machine or Mac, can grab that code, start working on it, test it, and then commit it back to GitHub, and then the author of the owner of the repository can, look at merging that code in. So it's kind of a
So do you use Git to download that code on? So say if you had a new customer or whatever, and you wanted to install that your code, can you then use that Git command to go to your GitHub to pull back the code?
No, because all the code lives on my server. The way Git works is distributed. So I can have a load of code on as a completely separate server. And I'll I'll make that into a Git repository, and then I can upload that to GitHub. What I've done here is just take these two bits of code and upload them to GitHub from my Git repository on my server. Because it's distributed. So now to do that, I had to take the bits that I wanted and make a separate Git repository, and then upload that Git repository to GitHub. If you see what I mean. So, the reason that I haven't put all my code on GitHub is because there might be sensitive information in my Ansible stuff. So you have to kind of be careful that because it's public, you don't want to upload stuff.
Wasn't what an odd camp last year? Someone was saying you can you can search stuff for people's SSH passwords and stuff.
AWS. Keys as well. A lot of people sort of mistakenly or accidentally put stuff on GitHub. Now the way GitHub works is you can have a free account and all your stuff is public, or you can pay for a private account. But even then, I wouldn't upload my stuff to a private GitHub account because, you know, it's on their servers. Yeah. So I would be very careful about doing that. In my day job, we've used this thing called GitLab, which is like a self-hosted GitHub. It's really good, actually, good piece of software. To just store our code and have you've got an interface like GitHub, but obviously it's not public. It's you can only the members of your team can see it, and but it's got a lot of the functionality that GitHub has. So yeah, worth a look. I'll stick a link in the show notes. If you want to play around with it, I recommend the Omnibus package because it installs everything. You hardly have to do any configuration, and it's easy to get going with it, which is what I did.
So we're going to have a bit of a chat tonight, because normally lately just been kind of chatting about what we kind of do in our day-to-day, what we've been doing. But we're going to talk a bit about configuration management tonight. So
have you come across configuration management at all?
Well, I've heard a lot of people talk about people like good DevOps and stuff, and what with our more of our more of our Windows stuff is that most of our stuff is that we do everything by kind of like group policy. It's basically we can force settings on different computers depending on what we want it to do, but we don't have that many kind of text files and stuff. But there's a product which is basically a Windows product, which is SCCM, which is System Center Configuration Manager, which kind of does the same kind of thing where you can do it so that you can roll out registry keys, you can run scripts on PCs, all from one kind of management center. But what I understand of what you're doing for Greg Management is that obviously with Linux, you've got lots of scripts, haven't you, really, in there so you basically want a way of keeping all those things the same, kind of like making sure that every machine has the correct the right version of whatever software you're using on it, kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the difference, I suppose, between what you do and what I do. Is the config is the majority of the time is in text files. So a lot of the time with configuration management in Linux, you're basically copying a text file to a certain place. But it tends to be what they call a template, where you've got the text file, but you've got a bit in the text file which is a variable. So say it might be a different host name on a different machine, so you can put in a variable for host name, and then somewhere else you define what the host name should be. So you can have like conditional things. So say if it's machine A, then the host name is this, or if it's machine B, the host name is this. So that's a sort of power of templating like that. And what I found with, especially with Ansible, is the power is in the template, really. And then you can conditionally have a template, or you can do something like, I don't know if you've ever configured Apache, have you, or a virtual host on Apache? Yeah. With that, you have a lot of blocks of code that are the same, but part of that is different. So you can say in a template, you can have a for loop of, say, this block of code is this, and it's got this bit of text in it, and then repeat that exact same block of code, but instead of the bit I put in A, in the first block, put a different bit in the second block, depending on all these variables. So in Apache, for instance, it'd be a list of websites, so you could have a list somewhere else of the websites and where the websites are on the disk or whatever, and then you just stick that into your template, and you've only got to do that one block and have it loop over that block for however many websites you have, for instance. So that's the power of templating templating it. And I mean, to go into configuration management a bit more, you've got in Puppet, I mean, maybe I should rewind a bit. The two configuration management tools I've used are Puppet and Ansible. Puppet, I think, is probably the oldest of the current generation of configuration management things. Now, I mean, with a Linux server, you can write shell scripts all day long, and you can configure your server through shell scripts if you like. But the problem is, those are your shell scripts. You wrote them. You can't give them to someone else, and for someone else to know how they work. So, for me, that's where configuration management comes in and becomes powerful. It kind of democratizes that. If someone knows how to use Puppet, or they know how to use Ansible, they can look at your code, and they can know exactly what you've done with that code and how you've done it. And it provides a framework for it's like having a load of shell scripts, but it's kind of a framework that anyone can read, or that anyone knows how to use, or they can take it and modify it for how they want to use it. Now Puppet has this concept of there's three important things with any bit of configuration, and that is the file that you're going to edit, whether that's going to be a template or whatever, as we discussed earlier, the package that you want to install to, you know, have that available, and the service, which you should call it a service in Windows or a daemon in Linux, the software that runs, and is what you configure with the file bit, and is what is installed by the package bit, and those are the three important things, which is, I think, is quite a good way of looking at it. So yeah, I mean, that's really the basis of it. Puppet is, just look at my notes.
So Puppet is, you need an agent for, you're saying?
Yes, yeah. So you need a bit of software on the thing that you want to configure, and they're called nodes in Puppet. And what that does is it talks to the Puppet master. It doesn't have to. You don't need a Puppet master with Puppet necessarily, but most people use it like that. It talks to the Puppet master. On the Puppet master is a configuration, which is probably not very radio friendly, but I can put in some good probably examples in the show notes. And so the Puppet node talks to the Puppet master, and the Puppet master goes, it hears the node talking to it, and it says, right, this node needs configuring. Have I got any configuration in my tree for this node? And it'll go down, look through all the configuration, and it'll gather anything that it has, send that back to the node. I think it compiles, you know, it does something, and then compiles that into a sort of blob, sends that back to the node, and the node knows what to do with that. Like if it needs to install a service, it'll install the package, it'll install it. And if it needs to configure it, it'll do that, and it'll kind of work out in it for itself what it needs to do, and that's in my understanding anyway, because I haven't got coding background. that's declarative. It says basically, I need to reach this state, and it's up to you how you reach that state. So just go off and do it, sort of thing. So that's how Puppet works. And if you do that on a node, and you sort of set a debug flag, you can see what the steps it goes through to do that. Whereas Ansible is more of a step-by-step thing. You have to say, first do this, and then you do this, and then you do this, and then you're done. But you can do that. The power of that is you can do that over, you know, hundreds of nodes at a time. And if you write your roles properly, then, you know, you just sort of set and forget, as they say, set it off and you've got you come back and you've got all your nodes configured. So yeah, that's sort of 10,000 foot view, as they say. Of,
so you're basically just saying Ants will use SSH to go and then does it what it needs to.
Yeah, so they're all designed to work over an untrusted network, if you like, that being the internet. I mean, a lot of people use AWS. And so you've got to have some way of communicating securely with your nodes from your master or the machine that's doing the configuring. And Puppet uses SSL, so it uses SSL infrastructure. Mm-hmm. To talk between nodes, so that's all encrypted as it goes back and forth. So you need to set that up initially. So you get a node, you have to get it to talk to the Puppet Master, and then you have to do something on the Puppet Master to say, yep, this node's okay, I'll sign the certificate for that, and from then on you've got secure communication. Ansible uses SSH, I think it sends commands over SSH. So normally with a Linux box you'd have SSH already set up, so that once you've done that, you're done with Ansible. You can do your you can set a configuration off to go, and it'll just do it because you've already got SSH set up. You don't have to do anything else.
Cool.
That's a very brief overview of configuration management. I've probably could talk about it a bit more in future podcasts, how I've been using it and so on, and maybe a few tips, or maybe listeners have tips.
So what is Chef then compared to what's Chef well, then?
That's a very good question because I haven't actually used Chef. So it's as I understand it, it's written in Ruby. I mean, I think Puppet's but is kind of based in Ruby, or it's written originally in Ruby, and some of its parts are Ruby, like the templates. If you want to write templates in Puppet, you have to know Ruby. But as I understand it, Chef is a bit closer to Ruby. I haven't used it, so I can't really report on too much about it. But it is very popular. You know, it's kind of the third. There's Puppet, Chef, and Ansible are the three that are sort of in quite heavy use today. There's another one called Saltstack. Mm-hmm. As well, but I
so is Puppet free to use then? Is it like
they've got an open source they've got open source, which is perfectly usable, or the enterprise version, which you have to pay for. I think you pay per node, and I've been on Puppet training and they said well, we're not too fussy about you paying for it, but if you want support, you'll have to pay for it, sort of thing. Which is really the
which is a typical kind of Linux thing, isn't it?
Mm.
Where you get the kind of like you get an open source version, and if you want support, then you have to pay for it.
Yeah. But from what I can see, Puppet Enterprise hasn't really got much over open source apart from the support. And I think it's in some respects it's a bit more complicated. So
and I think Chef, there's a Windows client for it as well.
Hmm. All right, yeah, you can. There is a Windows client for Puppet as well.
All right,
but I haven't used it.
So, what about the old? So you talk about version control as well. Is that another major feature of
you have to use in because it's code at the end of the day. I think you have to use version control just to keep track of your code because it's things like someone makes a change, you have to know who made the change. If you're working in a team, So you have to have some way of tracking that, or even if you're not, not just to blame someone if something goes wrong, but just to see what actually, if something does go wrong, what went wrong, what changed between this this commit and the next commit. So you have to have some kind of version control there. Again, at my day job, we've been using Git. I've actually been pushing for Git to be used because basically the rest of the world is using it. And there's things like you can get code on GitHub, for instance, Puppet code, which people have used, tested, and everything else. And you can just download it. You know, you don't have to really think about it, although you should obviously audit the code before you put it in, and so on. But
cool.
Yeah, I mean, Git is just lends itself, it seems, to this kind of thing. And we're using it at work now we're using the branching functionality of it, and something called hooks with Git, which is basically something that you do when you commit the code, and you push it to, say, we have a master branch, a test branch, and then a what we're working on branch. And when we go from, when we push from the, when we merge the code from the what we're working on branch to the test branch, that automatically copies a load of files over to where they should be, so that we don't have to do that manually. And then when that's tested, we push it to the master branch, which is production. Mm-hmm. So that goes out to everywhere, and it's all done through Git and hooks, where you effectively copy the code by pushing it, which doesn't happen automatically. It's something you have to set up. So yeah, that's I'd say version control is essential. Especially, I mean, you should use it really when you change things on the Linux box. You should really use version control, just so you can roll back if you need to.
Yeah, well, normally if I'm doing some config on a file, I'll normally make a backup it first before.
You should always do that. That actually, a bit of a tip actually is that there's a, I may have mentioned it before, etc keeper on Linux. Install that, and it should make a Git repository out of your etc directory.
Yeah.
And it does a commit every day, so that if you make a change, it'll add that. It knows what's changed, which Git does by default, and then it'll commit that, so that you can always roll back to the previous day's etc directory if you need to.
Yeah.
Or you can commit it again, you know, whenever you want, you know, before you make a change or whatever. One more thing I wanted to mention about configuration management is something called idempotency. And what that is it basically says if I run this code once or twice or three times, if I run it and it makes a change, then if I run it again, and the change has already been made, I won't make it again. So that's quite an important concept, because you could have something, you know, that makes a change to a system. Maybe it adds a 1 to a number in a configuration file or something, and you don't want it adding that number every time it runs. So you have to make sure that it doesn't, basically. And that's basically idempotency. If I change something to this state, then it needs to stay in that state, unless I tell it otherwise. So that's what that's all about, and it's a feature of configuration management systems.
Mm-hmm.
So brief rundown really. I probably went on a bit there, but that's the basics of it, as I understand it. Happy to hear anything that anyone else has to say about it, listeners, listener feedback or whatever.
No, it's definitely interesting. I've learnt a bit, so that's quite good. So,
I mean, I think basically gone are the days of doing everything yourself, either typing it in the command line or writing your own shell scripts to do it. This is a lot more powerful, and it's what everyone's using, and it's what people increasingly want, is large amounts of machines doing what they're told to do, and that's how you do it. This is how you do it, you know.
Cool. Okay, well, I think we're nearly there to the end of the show, but apparently the Og dates have been released, haven't they? The Og Camp dates have been released for this year. I'm planning on going. So that's in Liverpool this year, and so hopefully you might be able to meet up with Andy and have a kind of a live podcast. I don't know, maybe not at the show or whatever, but maybe.
I don't want to go on stage.
But have a meetup kind of thing. So when is, do you know when the date is?
It's the last weekend in October, isn't it? It's Halloween. So it's I think that's 30th, 31st, and 1st of November.
Yeah.
I definitely recommend it to anyone that's even vaguely interested in community and technology and maker stuff and anything like that, really. So that's where we met last year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's
definitely worth going. So So we'll put the note. There's nothing on. We'll put the dates in the show notes.
Talks there.
Yeah. It's just a good place to meet people, really, and stuff. So.
We met our podcasting heroes there last year, didn't we?
But they still haven't had anything back from. They haven't replaced Linux Outlaws yet, which I'm still missing. So.
No.
And when I've actually been on holiday the last couple of weeks, I got well behind on my podcast. So this week I've actually managed to get back to zero.
Oh, right, yeah.
But because it really annoyed. But now I've been really busy at work for a couple of days doing a load of writing some proposals, and I'm now 14 hours behind, and it really annoys me that I'm not spending that time in the car anymore. It's just kind of
That's the worst. I mean, when you're actually spending time with your family and stuff, you can't listen to podcasts. I don't know about you, but my kids don't like listening to podcasts. They find it boring, but little do they know. We'll get them in the end.
Good. Okay, well, we'll speak soon then.
Got another podcast out, so we're making up for that month we missed.
Yeah. But we actually said yesterday that we actually did try. We did this last show. It's like our first anniversary show, and we've actually done 24, so it's kind of like two in the years or whatever.
Oh yeah, I saw that. Yeah, happy birthday.
Good. Okay, then we'll speak soon, guys.
Yeah. Good to talk, and see you again soon.
Bye for now.
Bye.